Two acronyms have become so familiar in the discussions over economic policy, taxing and spending, that media presenters and interviewers no longer spell out the words, but just their initials, the IFS and OBR. The Institute for Fiscal Studies, or IFS, has become the nation's go-to institution for judgments about tax, spending and borrowing. Meanwhile, the Office of Budget Responsibility, the OBR, is the independent official watchdog that assesses the viability and sustainability of the government's economic plans, given what it thinks about them and the economy. It was trying to bypass the OBR, you'll remember, that contributed to the downfall of Prime Minister Liz Truss. With me today is Sir Robert Choate, who has run both the IFS for 8 years, the OBR for 10 years, and knows better than anyone on the planet how they both work. He's also currently chair of the UK Statistics Authority and the Northern Ireland Fiscal Council. So, going back to the OBR and IFS, are they two essentially conservative in their worldview? How independent are they in reality? What's he most proud of in that long period he was running both of them? What does he most regret? And where now for the British economy? Robert, welcome to the We Society podcast.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I ask all our guests this, and I'll ask you too. We Society, what was your thought when you heard, I'm going on the We Society podcast with Will Hutton? We Society, what were you thinking about?
Well, I think when you first approached me, I was actually talking to the Scottish Fiscal Commission, so I was initially thought you meant a small society vision. But no, I did appreciate the greater breadth of your vision.
Look, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, you had a career in journalism, the Independent and the Financial Times, and this kind of long period, 8 years at the IFS and 10 years at the kind of OBR. I mean, and now the UK Statistics Authority. I mean, you are kind of had a bird's eye view, really, of kind of British economic policy making for kind of decades, and actually inside the entrails of these two institutions. I mean, let's start with the IFS. What are you most proud of in that period you're running it?
Well, I think if you look at both of those institutions, indeed, the Northern Ireland Fiscal Council as well, I'm a one-trick pony, really, and I'm really just carrying on from my beginnings in journalism as largely trying to be a good reporter, which is, in different ways and in different contexts, these institutions are trying to examine the complexities of the economy, the way in which the government's decisions on taxation and spending are affecting people's behaviours and outcomes. Looking at all that as carefully as you can, distilling the most important messages and learnings from that, and explaining them as clearly and honestly as you can to the public. And I think in doing that, and this is a constant theme through all of them, that you need to show you're working, and you need to be upfront about the uncertainties that lie around almost every judgment that you make because of the uncertainties around the data that goes into it, the uncertainties about what we know about how people behave, what we know about the broader context as well. So when I came to the IFS, it obviously already had a reputation, as you say, for being the go-to institution. I was very lucky to take over from Andrew Dilnot, who we both know, who's, you know, obviously widely admired as a
communicator. And being a broadcaster here on the We Society podcast.
Indeed, yeah. Absolutely. And explaining in a non-partisan but humble way what we can and can't know about the way in which public policy is affecting the economy, affecting people's behaviour, and to communicate that as best you can. Now, what I was certainly conscious of at the IFS is that I was essentially not appointed to it for my Nobel Prize winning contributions to theoretical economics. I'd been a reporter and hopefully a reasonably good, you know, analyst and communicator. But I also knew that when I returned from the Newsnight studio or the Today programme, I have to look the David Ricardo Professor of Political Economy from UCL in the face when I get back to the office, and therefore you don't say things that aren't robustly based. Now, obviously, as you know, in economics, social policy more generally, almost every statement can be contested or argued over. That's absolutely as it should be. But what you need to do is to show you're working and hopefully do so in a way that if people take different judgments about some of the key determinants, then you're helping them reach their own different conclusions, as well as just setting out, this is my view, this is the truth, take it or leave it.
I take all that, and I think that, I mean, the fact you're still standing,
robustly
kind of answering these questions in the studio is kind of a tribute to the fact that, you've kind of managed the kind of snakes and ladders of it quite well. I mean, how, especially the OBR, I mean, are you lent on by the Treasury? I mean, how does it, are too many of the assumptions that you kind of work with ones which are necessarily so mainstream that you can't ever say anything which is kind of slightly off the wall or kind of outside the box? And, I mean, do you feel constrained in the way that you're conducting both organisations, or in particular the OBR, I think?
Well, the OBR is an interesting one because of the way it fits into the budget setting process. So when the OBR was created, there were already plenty of what in the jargon are known as fiscal councils or independent fiscal institutions.
Around the world.
So these are bodies that are both official but also independent from government. They're there to provide non-partisan analysis of the public finances and of
what's the acronym, the IFIs?
IFIs, yeah. Yes. Providing non-partisan analysis of the impact of government policy on the public finances. And in doing that, you obviously have to reach a view on the economy as well. Now, the OBR and these bodies don't have any privileged information really about what's going on in the economy over and above what all the other economic forecasters who are doing the job on a day-to-day basis are doing. The key thing to remember about the OBR and these bodies is that they have to take a view on the economy because this gets you to a view on the public finances. You're trying to explain
what tax revenues will be.
Exactly. What are tax revenues? What is public spending? What does that mean for the budget deficit? What does that mean for government debt? What does that mean for the broader measures of the government's balance sheet? So you need a view on the economy for that. You need it to be transparent as well. And if you look certainly over the period when I was there and afterwards, the OBR's economic forecasts, which are an input, not really the ultimate output, certainly don't veer away enormously from, say, the average of external forecasters or the view that the Bank of England publishes, for example. Of course, the Treasury itself no longer publishes any forecasts. That's a big difference with the IFIs in most other countries, where the fiscal watchdog essentially is second-guess or producing an alternative view. In this country, the Treasury has, rather courageously actually, outsourced the task of producing the official forecast.
I'm not sure they're entirely happy about it, actually, but I mean,
I think the wise ones see the bigger benefit, even though, you know, from time to time you do test their patience with the things that you have to say and messages that they would rather not hear. I think there would have been a challenge. There would have been nothing to stop us taking a very, very heterodox or way away from consensus view of the economy and feeding that into our analysis of the public finances. I don't actually think that would have been very helpful, because what the OBR can add is a much more granular, detailed, thoughtful examination of the public finances, not we have any reason to believe that we're better than anybody else in terms of producing the forecast, which is one of the reasons as well, when you're producing your assessment of where the public finances are going, you at the same time say, well, what happens if growth is stronger or weaker than we expect? What happens if oil prices are higher or lower? What happens if the interest rates at which the government can borrow are higher or lower? So no one should bet the farm on any particular economic or public finance forecast turning out to be correct. You do need to have a central estimate, your best guess, but you also need to explain to people what the uncertainties are around that and how things might turn out differently, and point out to people that there are some things that could turn out differently that, frankly, it doesn't make a big difference to the overall picture. There are other things to which the big picture is really quite
sensitive.
Give
an example. Give an example of that.
Well, I think if you were to, take the biggest single determinant of the long-term health of the public finances from the economic perspective, it's what we call potential GDP. It's the amount the economy could produce in the future without pushing upward or downward pressure on inflation. That is something that is something you have to estimate. You can't see it out there in the real world, but to a small adjustment to saying, for example, because you take a different view on how productivity is going to perform, on how the supply of labour is going to perform, on what's going to happen to investment, if you change that, then it makes a big difference. Whereas if the economy is just wobbling around on a quarter-to-quarter basis, basically that can come out in the wash and it doesn't have a big impact on the view you're going to take of where the economy is, where the public finances are in 5-10 years' time.
I think there are a number of criticism of it. I mean, there's also, of course, the kind of salutary episode of the Liz Truss budget without it. So, you know, so criticism is always kind of slightly has to be more than slightly has to be qualified by if you didn't have it, you get into some serious trouble with the financial markets. But one criticism was that in the kind of 2010s, particularly after Brexit, it consistently kind of underestimated the impact of the financial, ongoing impact of the financial crisis on productivity, which it hoped would rise, but never did. And the other criticism is it doesn't really seem to believe in our public investment, except in the very, very long term, ever producing much more growth. What's your response to those two points?
Well, I think, as you say, I mean, the critiques of the OBR generally come in the critiques around individual forecasting judgments, or there's the view that it's somehow a bunch of unelected technocrats who are inappropriately constraining ministerial policy ambitions. And so some of the more recent criticisms have been as much in that as in the particular
forecast. That's from both the left and the right. I mean, Liz Truss would say you were the deep state, and the left might say, you know, you just don't see the merits of public spending.
Yes, to expand on that, you would get, for example, some people saying the OBR doesn't accept the transformative potential for a major tax-cutting agenda to revive animal spirits, to generate impressive underlying economic potential in the long term. You certainly get that criticism. It's also a criticism that has been levelled by the right at the Congressional Budget Office in the United States, for example. On the left, I think you would certainly have had that situation had elections gone other ways, of the OBR doesn't appreciate that we've got this huge, massive green investment program that's going to be utterly transformative. And in part, in both of those areas, I think that, you know, theory and experience would suggest that it's probably not inappropriate for the OBR to be sceptical about this and to try to look for some of the evidence of this showing up in the data. But to a considerable degree, it's a matter of timescale. So if you are going to have a sort of a major set of changes, be it public investment, be it, you know, major change in the planning regime, for etc., some of those things will have quite big upfront costs. And quite a lot of the benefits, if you believe those benefits are going to come, although not much of it will have shown up by the 5-year horizon that the OBR has been told to produce its forecasts over. The OBR does also produce longer term projections. They're more stylized. The public pays less attention to them. The OBR has done some very interesting work recently, I think, on what is the evidence about the impact that higher public investment has on not growth in the short term, in the sort of sugar rushing the economy, but in the, you know, increasing the ability, the underlying potential of the economy to generate goods and services, of which you can argue clearly that improvements in infrastructure would be a very good way of doing that, but would go much further. I mean, my Northern Ireland context at the moment, so I've been, you know, beavering away in the last few days on a report we're doing on Northern Ireland Water, the organisation that does water and sewerage supply there. And there, a big part of that argument is if you don't improve that infrastructure, you can't have economically advantageous residential and commercial development. It's a big problem around Belfast, etc. And so, again, you're looking at that and then some of those. If you had that improvement, if you had that impact, it's not going to show up in a, you know, easily in a 1, 2, 3, 4 year budget planning horizon, but that doesn't mean it's not beneficial. And I think there is a sort of genuine issue. Governments have to be quite courageous. If you're going to do something that's going to be transformative at a 5, 10, 15 year horizon, you know, you can't complain that somebody's not going to show that having all its beneficial effects within five. That's not plausible and would undermine both the forecasts. But the government of the day would need to make that case with what evidence it could bring. And the OBR, as I say, certainly in the context of public investments, done some interesting work on that recently.
You make thousands of decisions every day. Most are inconsequential, but the big ones shape your future. There's a podcast that can help you make better decisions. It's called The Art of Deciding, with award-winning financial journalist Bruce Whitfield. Bruce asks high achievers how they make their biggest decisions, including Jack Reacher creator Lee Child, on how he took control of his future after being fired, poker champion Liv Borry on why trusting your gut is not a strategy, plus the former chairman of the Court of the Bank of England, Sir Brad Freed, who delivers a masterclass in managing strong teams. The Art of Deciding with Bruce Whitfield is available wherever you get your podcasts. How would you promote economic growth? You spent 8 years at the IFS, 10 years at the OBR. You're chair of the UK Statistics Authority. It would be very interesting to know what your view is.
Well, I think quite a lot of them. There have been many sort of commissions or studies in this area over the years, and they often come up with much the same list of things. So why don't we transform the planning regime to make it much more conducive to development? Can you improve the education system? Can you improve the quality of vocational system? Can you increase the quality of infrastructure? Can you ensure that you have a competition regime that is conducive to innovation and to growth? Now, I think a lot of those remain perfectly good and valid things to aim for. John Kingman, former Treasury official, came up with a very nice list of these relatively recently in those sorts of areas, talked about, the huge potential for developing the land between Oxford and Cambridge and using that to sort of have a real boost to innovation, talking about making eventually decisions on Heathrow Airport capacity. There's a whole lot of issues around that. And as you rightly say, I think the fact that people said, this wasn't a hugely sort of pro-growth budget, the one that we've had most recently, as you rightly point out, I think that was really about saying, what do we need to put in place to finance a realistic amount of resources for public services over the next 5 years? Those more microeconomic, more supply side measures, the government has still got time to think about that and do more on that scope. So the fact that this wasn't all in the budget, I don't think should have come as a great surprise to people who look at budgets a lot.
Kwasi Kwarteng, Trust, they take over, they have the toing and froing between the OBR and the Treasury. It takes, 6, 8, 10 weeks. They wanted to act really quickly, and they acted really quickly, having a budget within 30 days, and kind of, we'll do the OBR later. I mean, do you have any sympathy at all for Truss and Kwarteng?
Well, I think you have to remember the period that they were following. So the formal and indeed the informal way in which the OBR works, an iterative exchange of forecasts and policy proposals over an 8 to 10 week period in the run-up to a budget. The system was designed for that happening twice a year, a budget plus an autumn statement or a spring statement, depending on what time of year you were doing it. That obviously was blown out of the water with the COVID period. You essentially had 14 budgets in the space of 1 year, and, pretty chunkily sized ones as well. That was battlefield medicine. You could not have all the usual scrutiny that goes on for each of those episodes. There just simply aren't enough weeks in the year. And so when you emerged from that, I think it was always, and this wasn't just true in the UK, persuading ministers, parliaments indeed, to go back to proper processes previously defined was not straightforward, because they say, we've got urgent problems. We've got crises facing us now. We need to move quickly, as we had to do back then. I think that is to underestimate one of the greatest values, but most underappreciated things that the OBR does, which is not just the forecast that it produces, but the detailed scrutiny that it gives each line of tax revenue, forecasts that are being generated out of the of HM Revenue and Customs, for example, looking in detail at every policy measure that the Treasury is thinking of implementing and saying, how robust are the assumptions here on, you know, what data do we have? How do we think people will respond to this policy? You know, is it deliverable? Is the funding there to ensure that it can actually be operationalised? You know, that getting back to that, I think, was very important. I think one of the issues, obviously, around the Kwarteng Truss period is that they basically wanted to go ahead with the tax changes, basically a big tax giveaway, with the, oh, and we'll follow this up with spending later. So it's not just the absence of an OBR forecast, but also that perception of it's, you know, the jam was today. How confident can we be that the, you know, that the bread is going to follow to accompany it afterwards. So exactly how much of the market reaction was down to, you know, the OBR hasn't had the chance to run the slide rule over this, over the fact that this was basically, you know, a tax package ahead of a spending package, is for individual, you know, investors to have decided.
And they did.
And they did.
Give us the chote list of bugbears or thing or things that have really kind of got you going over the years.
Well, I think so. In general principle stuff, the idea, which is one of the things that I'm involved in, sort of promoting and policing at the moment, is as chair of the UK Statistics Authority. Part of that is effectively chairing the Office for Statistics Regulation, which is part of which its role is essentially to have to come up with, to explain and promote, and then to police a code of practice for statistics, which is partly about how you produce them, but also about how you communicate them. And as you'll appreciate, be it on buses or tweets or other things, politicians will naturally want to make crisp, quantitative soundbite statements about, you know, it's 350 here, it's 2,000 there, it's 4,000 here. We've seen a lot of this. And often with those, you can define a question to which that is the answer. But it's probably if you hear the number, not the question that people think you're asking. And so one of the things that we try to do is popularise what the Office for Statistics Regulation calls intelligent transparency. And one of the things I think that's important there is if you are a minister or a special advisor or a comms team in a department or a political party, and you're thinking about making some sort of quantitative statement about, you know, X is going to be 300, 500 million, 100,000 higher, how would the average person in the street, what would they think you meant by that? And you need to be very wary of situations where you're putting out a simple number and people would only really be able to understand the question if you gave them 8 pages of explanatory notes. And you can't put 8 pages of explanatory notes on a tweet or on a bus. So I think it's always a good discipline to say, think about this number. You may have managed to come up with some formulation that gets you to a nice round figure that sounds good in a speech, but will people understand where that has come from? Will you be able to point people to the data that underpins it, the assumptions that have underpinned it?
You're crying for the moon, but that's utopian. I mean, you're never going to get there.
I think you have to point out that if you don't do that, if you're not responsible in the way you behave, you undermine the public's confidence in the next time you make those sorts of statements. And you may undermine confidence in the other quantitative statements that your department or your office or whatever it puts out. And you may also undermine people's confidence in the use of statistics and of quantitative claims in public debate and discourse anyway. So I think it's worth trying to push water up that hill and to point out that it is in the interests of people making statements of this sort not to find themselves, you know, getting a letter of, you know, more in sadness than in anger from me or being disputed by the IFS, etc., because it's going to affect how people treat their future statements and confidence in the public discourse more generally. But it's much more complicated in a world in which people are communicating by infographic, by tweet, buses are less frequent. than a, you know, a long government paper where you have the space to explain how it is exactly that you've come up with this number and you can stick a nice footnote in.
Data sharing. You're promoting data sharing. It sounds like apple pie and motherhood.
Yeah, I mean, this stems from, I mean, the starting point is the fact that the data that different parts of the public sector collect about citizens and about businesses and other things is a huge asset to the government that can generate insight and understanding that can promote better policy, can help the engagement of the citizen with the state in their interactions with it. And therefore, you want to make the most of that. I mean, look at the huge tech companies who have massive market capitalizations based on what they can do with the data they have about people. Governments are in the same way. They're not in the, you know, not monetizing it in quite the same way.
That's but a very nice idea. What you're saying is that, you know, NVIDIA, Microsoft, Google, Facebook, all of them with these kind of Apple, with these kind of trillion-dollar market capitalizations, it's all built on their command of and capacity to monetize data. But actually, one institution has even more data than them. It's the government. And actually, let's do something with it.
Absolutely. And so, if you have data from the tax system or from the health system or what you get out of the census, what you get out of other surveys, the whole is potentially so much greater than the sum of the parts if you can link these things together.
Give us an example.
And draw answers.
Give us an example.
Well, some recent work that's been done essentially linking health data with labour market data to say if the NHS spends more money on bariatric surgery, how does that show
bariatric up? Surgery.
You're getting me into the technicalities here.
Yeah, come on, you're a technocrat. Come on.
I'm not a medical specialist, so I will leave somebody else to precisely define what that is. But, you know, if you invest in this particular sort of treatment, is that going to affect people's labour market incomes? And then it brings you into a whole richer discussion of value for money around that. Now, as you say, you may say motherhood and apple pie. Why wouldn't you pull all of this stuff together? And obviously, there are a whole set of practical and ethical concerns. People, I think there's a sort of social contract and a social license here is that the public, if you are handing over information to different, you know, elements of government and they want to use that, you know, to provide an evidence base, not just for the particular purpose that you had to provide it originally, then they need to feel that that's being, you know, looked after properly, looked after securely. It's not being disclosive. So if you are linking it together, it's not inappropriate as far as the individual citizen is concerned. But I think actually a lot of people are surprised that the government is not making more use of the data that has already, rather than sort of being anxious about moving too far in that direction. So there's then the question is, why doesn't it happen as much as you would like it to? And there I think that there's a number of issues at play, but part of it is if you are a given department or a government body and you're thinking about, should I, you know, put my data, either share it or put it into the pot where it can be accessed and linked, the benefits of that are quite widely spread. You know, it's not just going to be benefits accruing to you. It's going to be to wider public policy. It's going to help other departments do their job more effectively, etc. So the benefits are diffuse, but the anxieties about what if something goes wrong, you feel are very close to home. So if this data is used inappropriately or insecurely, then that's going to land on my doorstep, whereas the positive outcomes of this are going to be more widely spread. So I think that's one reason for anxiety. I think that departments may fear that if they share their data, other people will discover that it's not as good as they might have thought it was because they're able to play with it and to rootle around with it. There may be people who are concerned that the data will be used with different narratives. People will draw different unhelpful conclusions from it, different to the ones that you'd have liked to have got out there. So I think it does require, you know, political leadership at the centre to either reassure or to say, look, you know, for the greater public good, it's important that this happens. We should have a presumption that this data is shared as long as it can be done securely and appropriately and for sensible and appropriate objectives, and used flexibly. So yes, it's important that if you're going to make a particular use of the data, that there should be appropriate gateways of getting permission to do it, but not so onerous that you can't actually do it for ages and the opportunity to make the most of it has gone. So I think it is, and that's one of the reasons why I wrote recently a piece arguing that with a new government setting that as an expectation early on, that data sharing should be a presumption rather than an exception, is something that would be beneficial for the public. It will help government make greater and better decisions, and it will help researchers and civil society understand society and the economy better and be able to draw in more interesting and useful insights.
Is there one thing, is there one thing that you've consistently thought over your career?
Don't put all your eggs in the one basket. Be thinking simultaneously about what you can do on infrastructure, what you can do on education, what you can do on competition, etc. I think that you need to take that breadth of view rather than, taking all your chips and sticking them on, 32 black or whatever it might be. A sensible thing would be to do that more widely.
Do you regret having left journalism? And do you sometimes think writing critiques about policy instead of trying to kind of objectively say things about it?
Well, occasionally there's twinges, I've got a great story, and then you remember you haven't got anywhere to write it these days. I guess that would be...
you could tell me.
Well, yes. No, I haven't. As I say, to some degree, pretty much every job I've done has been trying to be a decent reporter. And whether I've managed to do that more successfully than when I was actually a reporter is for other people to judge. But I still find it enormously rewarding and fun for whatever different audiences you're doing it to, as I say, take a complex picture of the world, try to get down to the essentials of it, try to say, well, this is what's important, this isn't, present it as dispassionately as you can, but be humble about the conclusions you can draw and what another reasonable person could draw from the same set of information if they took a different set of judgments. And that was as true as when I was, writing columns for The Independent, as well as I'm trying to work out what you should do with Northern Ireland water.
I was going to say, thank you very much, Robert. And I thought perhaps I should say thank you very much, Sir Robert. And I know that you're slightly, this knighthood, I mean, you wear it slightly lightly. What's your view of being?
Well, it's very nice. This is the old cliche. It's a reflection of the hard work of many people that I've had the honour to work with in the different institutions that I've had. I mean, with both the IFS and the OBR, I'm always conscious that I would be completely unqualified to do most of the proper jobs within those organisations. But putting a sort of veneer at the top is the contribution I can make. I hope it's been useful, but it's just the knowledge of the, people in on the academic side, it's IFS, etc., and working in public service as well. The professionalism, the comradeliness, the sheer fun of doing that. It's been a huge privilege.
Sir Robert Chape, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. The We Society is brought to you by the Academy of Social Sciences, who can be found at acss.org.uk. I'm Will Hutton, the producer is Emily Finch, and it's a Whistledown production. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the podcast, leave a comment, share with your colleagues and friends. Thank you so much for listening.